Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Well, readers, when this reaches you, it may be 2026, it may still be 2025, but I do want to share with you the couplet by Ogden Nash, which goes, "Hark, it's midnight, children dear. Duck, here comes another year." And with the world the way it is, we'll all be ducking and covering, or so it seems, for quite a little while to come. However, I offer you stability, I offer you trustworthiness, I offer you old reliable, Dr. Jake Mann, who is our guest on Journal Club today, as always, and who has selected for us two articles on the theme of celiac disease. He wants to tell us how to treat it. He wants to tell us how to diagnose it. And we'll start, I think, with the treatment. A lovely little paper, it seems to me, Jake, demonstrating how easy it can be to carry out meaningful research, and that is by Risnes, LF, writing from a handful of institutions in Oslo in alimentation and pharmacologic therapy, teriflunomide does not affect gluten-specific T-cell activity in celiac disease. Jake, how would you sum up what these folks did?
So this is an interesting phase 2A study which really looked to see if they gave a novel T-cell modifying drug and to a small group of individuals with known celiac disease compared to placebo, and whether that altered their circulating T-cell activation against gluten-specific epitopes.
So what they did was they gave some kids the placebo, they gave some kids the modifying drug, and then they lined them up and had them eat a slice of bread.
Or several slices of bread.
Ah, they exactly. Were a real challenge. All right.
Yeah, exactly. And demonstrated that in patients who were in remission, that baseline they had very low to zero levels of activation of these T-cell specifics, markers of activation in T-cells specific for gluten. And then following the challenge with bread, they saw a peak. And then in the washout period, the levels of activation came back down. And the hope was that if they gave this T-cell modifying drug, you would ablate some of the spike in the T-cell activation. To cut to the chase, they didn't. There was no difference.
Teriflunomide, let's just call her Terry for short. What made people think that Terry was a suitable drug for celiac patients?
So it is a drug that primarily acts on pyrimidine synthesis, and it acts specifically on an enzyme, dihydroorate dehydrogenase, or DHODH for short.
I bet you can't say that twice.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
And we know that pyrimidine pathway is particularly important in T cells. For example, it is generally targeted by the azathioprine, which many people will be familiar with for our use in autoimmune liver diseases, autoimmune GI diseases. So the general pathway is meant to be important, and then teriflunomide is also thought to have some role in altering T-cell metabolism, though I'm unsure whether this is secondary to the alteration in pyrimidine synthesis or primarily. Either way, it is meant to perturb T-cell activity, and therefore you would conclude in a disease that has a very specific T-cell mediated response against a specific known antigen, that if you can ablate some of that T-cell activity, then you would inhibit some of the autoimmunity.
So again, 15 kids, 10 given Terry, 5 given placebo, and then every day for 3 days, a slice of white bread. And after the first slice, measure the acute response indicator, interleukin-2, and on day 15, 8 days from the first day of the challenge, then count gluten-specific CD4-expressing T cells in blood. Those are the ones that are detected by HLA-DQ2.5 in combination with gluten tetramers. Well, there were substantial both acute and longer-term inflammatory responses, but as you pointed out, Terry didn't make a difference. Is this a dead end, Jake?
I think that it is enough evidence to say that you wouldn't pursue a further trial of this drug in celiac disease. To me, it seems like a well-conducted preliminary study with appropriate placebo control, really nice reporting of individual data points. The differences are very clearly not there. The data is obviously the same between the two groups, so there's no way you could confabulate that there is some subtle difference. So I would not be inclined to follow up this drug for celiac disease. What it doesn't mean is that there is no T-cell modifying drug that would ever be suitable for celiac
disease.
Are
you asking us to prove a negative again?
No, I'm just saying that that
that was an this, evil laugh.
This doesn't prove all negatives.
All right then. Well, then this study is of value, perhaps, in reading and appreciating how well the experiments were framed and how well they are presented. And we can all use a reminder now and again of what good work looks like. And perhaps that is among the principal values of this study.
I was just going to add that it also highlights that doing a detailed study on a small number of individuals can give you very helpful results. So they didn't take a large number of participants, but by doing careful studies and using robust, well-established markers of disease activity, then they didn't have to go and do things like repeat endoscopies just to demonstrate what had happened, because they got a very clear signal. Now, of course, you didn't know if the data was going to be more murky at the end of it, and then they would need to do biopsies and a fully follow-up study. But as it happens, they got a very obvious response. And I suppose by proof of principle, it means that if we're interested in other rare diseases, if you have a cohort that is relatively small, you could still study a specific drug, look at a particular circulating biomarker in detail, and the serial sampling from before intervention afterwards allows you to draw conclusions. Whereas if, for example, they had just done a single time point analysis in all these patients, it would have been much harder to draw those conclusions.
Well, we talked about diagnosis, or sorry, we talked about treatment, and now it's time to turn to diagnosis. And Jake, you've chosen what strikes me as a histopathologist as a remarkably pernicious piece of mischief making. That is from JPGN by Mandile et al., working in Naples and Rotterdam. And I would like to point out that God put the Alps in between those two places in order to prevent collaborations of this sort. A set of serum proteomic biomarkers differentiates celiac children from age and human leukocyte antigen-matched healthy controls. Since I entered histopathology, there has been a steady assault of procedures or, again, mischief intended to separate histopathologists from their financial support. That is to say, ever less invasive, ever fewer biopsies. And here these people are saying, well, do you know, if you have a particular pattern of inflammation in tissue from celiac disease patients, maybe you can find out what the proteome is doing in that tissue, and then maybe you can look in peripheral blood for species that are particularly enriched in the mucosa and in the proteomic output, looking for particular patterns of increases in inflammation pathway members, that is to say. Mandeley et al. Reviewed relative abundances of 92 such analytes in sera from 100 pediatric patients, 50 with active celiac disease, and 50 with HLA-DQ2, DQ8 at-risk phenotypes, who neither had clinically manifest CD nor who developed and who did not develop such celiac disease over the 9 years after serum sampling. So a study at least 10 years in the making and freezers full of serum samples, and now they take the serum samples and compare them to see if there's any predictive value in a predictive or diagnostic value in assessing patterns of biomarkers in the serum. Jake, have I summed this up appropriately?
Yes, and they've used what is a rapidly emerging and quite popular technology called the Olink proteomics technique, which is essentially a series of antibodies coupled to barcodes with a DNA tag on them, which means that then you can take your serum, combine it with their reagents, and then effectively do DNA sequencing on it to then get a relative readout of the number of the antibodies which were then linked to that, so those strings of DNA. And this general technique is becoming more available. It is the sort of basis also for several of the forms of spatial transcriptomics, and there are many Olink platforms, and this is one of the smaller focused ones just on 92 inflammation-related proteins. But it's a proof of concept, I suppose. And they, yes, looked in these cases and controls and observed a few differences. I think one important thing to start with is, in any study like this, case versus control is really important, particularly if you're working with relatively small numbers of individuals. The controls sound like they were pretty good controls. Firstly, they are HLA matched. Secondly, they were followed up for a long period of time and didn't get celiac disease, which is important. And finally, they were recruited as familial controls in an earlier screening study. So that is certainly an important starting point.
Age matched and of a single ethnic background.
Relatively age matched, yes. One of the points I was going to say is it's not clear whether they included age and sex as a covariate in their analyses or not.
All right. So they took three different sieves and passed the results through them, statistical sieves, I mean to say, and they came up with seven different proteins that, when present in abundance, said, you have celiac disease in 90% of children.
Yes, and these proteins can, to varying degrees through various tenuous pathways, can be linked to inflammation. The most single common pathway is the NF-kappa B pathway, which is a fundamental intracellular inflammatory pathway invoked in multiple cell types. The one of the key points really here is their statistical models. And the challenge with this is if you use three different models, you're obviously tripling your chance to find stuff. And I suppose my main short summary is that some of these proteins, there's probably only one or two that are significant rather than all of them. By which I mean, yes, there are seven that are different on the t-test, there's table one. However, they've done their method for adjustment for multiple testing. It's a slightly unusual method, which makes me just a little bit worried that they've played around with different methods to find the one that gives them the most significant results. Then table two, they do a univariate analysis and then a multivariate analysis. And the multivariate analysis I haven't seen, but I would generally expect to adjust for age and sex. And then the other thing is that you should certainly then further adjust the p-values, either for multiple testing or adjust the threshold based on the fact that you're doing at least seven tests. And if you were to do that, then at least one or two of these would drop off, leaving only a couple significant. And then finally, these other two models of effectively random forest model and this linear discriminant analysis model, they are quite good at finding a predictive algorithm in a single cohort. But to use them in a robust manner, you need a second independent cohort, unfortunately. Otherwise, it really is very difficult to conclude that what you found is true.
Then I've lost the plot, not unexpected, given that we're dealing with statistics. But isn't the 50 who aren't the 50 patients at risk who neither had nor developed celiac disease, aren't they your comparison cohort?
I suppose I mean the sort of standard for these sorts of studies is that you should do this in your discovery cohort or discovery case control study of patients with celiac disease and their controls. And then you go to a totally different center and then look in their serum of cases and controls, and you want to replicate. And then you'd only consider the findings that you found in both two effectively separate studies to be true in both individually as overall the true signal.
Well, I hope that somebody's got the freezers and the serum samples required to do that. I also may have misunderstood the nature of the analysis that pulled out the seven potential biomarkers. I thought that the seven were arrived at in a Venn diagram manner, and that the seven were those for which all three of the statistical methods individually picked out as participants. Did I get that wrong too?
Several of them overlapped between the different models, but not all of them overlapped on every model. And the ones that seemed consistent were caspase 8 at least came up in a couple of the models, and NT3, which is a gene I'm not familiar with, and the authors do comment it is essentially a gene that's involved in neurotrophic growth factor, seemed consistent across multiple models, but it's hard mechanistically to understand exactly how that is connected. Then, other than those, there was variation in the exact genes that contributed to each of the models.
All right. Well, maybe things aren't so dark for endoscopists and histopathologists as I had feared on originally reading this paper. What do you say?
I think that there is a very, very big jump to go from serum proteomics to replacing a well-established diagnostic tool. Where they have a huge role is in uncovering subtypes of disease, phenotypes, and risk stratifying individuals. But when you're talking about gross kind of case versus control differences, you would usually expect to be a large number of differences. And with these sorts of models, and when you measure hundreds and or thousands of different proteins, certainly in a single study, it is relatively straightforward to come up with a good error under the curve of the receiver operator characteristic.
Which means what they've found may be true, but it's too early to tell.
And I just would like to see it done in another independent study.
Right then. I'm not certain if I should say I wish all our listeners, well, the best of holidays in order to cover as much ground as possible, and a good new year, or whether I should say I hope that you had happy holidays and that you'll have a good new year. Either way, all the best to you who give us the feeling, Jake and me, that we're doing something worthwhile and that you like listening to us banter gently about pediatric gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition. Until the next time.
Speak soon, Alex.